So it's all here. The story of our time with the bar call.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has played host to the biggest names and best minds of our day, who have helped to tell the story of our times through candid, revealing conversations with the Barkoff. This podcast delivers them straight to you. Welcome to With the Barkoff. I'm Mark Updegrove.
David O. Stewart is the best-selling author of various books on American history and historical nonfiction. His latest book, George Washington, The Political Rise of America's Founding Father, examines the George Washington we may not know. Not the imposing, distantly formidable Washington on Mount Rushmore, but a flesh and blood younger Washington who makes mistakes, battles character flaws, and consciously puts himself on a road towards self-improvement and ultimately greatness. Stewart talks to us about what might be the ultimate comeback story from his book that the Wall Street Journal calls an outstanding biography with narrative drive that such a life deserves. David Stewart, welcome to With the Barkoff, and congratulations on the publication of George Washington, The Political Rise of America's Founding Father.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you write in the book's first chapter that you want your book to explore how George Washington became the titanic, near-legendary figure of the American founding. And you further say that the answers are necessarily as complicated as the man. So let's start with George Washington's nature. What makes him so complicated?
He has so many different sides to his character. He was very careful to present to the world an accomplished, calm, centered person. That was all part of his ability to command a room, his ability to earn trust from people. And there was a natural self-possession that he had, which he had from very earliest days. It was somewhat in conflict with a very emotional disposition. And he had a titanic temper, which when he tried desperately not to lose it in public or even in private much. But when he did, nobody ever forgot it. It was just so intimidating. He was a large man and he really could lose it. And he also, and this was something that I was not expecting, he had an emotional accessibility and emotional intelligence, which allowed him to connect with people very easily. A remarkable number of his contemporaries called him affable, which is not how we ever think of him. And, he wept in public on a couple of public occasions, which, you know, it's hard to imagine any of our leaders doing, but he was in touch with his feelings and not ashamed of them. He suffered a lot of loss in his life. And when he wrote about deaths, he wrote with real feeling. And I think he was able to connect with people in a way that a political leader really should. But we think of him as just this majestic character. And I don't think that's the whole story. It's part of the story, but it's also, he was just a very human guy.
David, how did he engender trust?
He had a natural air of command, you know, and I don't know. I suspect it can be learned, but he had it. He did not get flustered in stressful situations. He had confidence in himself, and he conveyed that. He also had terrible insecurities about his education, about his, frankly, his intelligence. In some instances, he was dealing with incredibly smart people. And he was able to control those in public. So I think it was also the last thing I was talking about before, which is they felt that he understood them, that he connected with them, and that he cared for them. There's a wonderful remark by a Frenchman who was with the army who said, it's as though he is everyone's father and brother. And he was able to connect that. He wasn't full of himself. I mean, we've ever had somebody who was entitled to be full of himself. It was George Washington, but He was a modest guy. He was unpretentious. These are all things that make you easier to deal with and easier to get along with, and it causes you people to trust you. And actually, one last thing.
Sure.
He gave up power.
Right. Cincinnatus approach. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, there's nothing like walking away from power to tell people, you know, don't be afraid of me. I'm really just going to try to do the best job I can.
And that's the George Washington of another book. But in this book, you write about his early years and how those early years inform the leader that we know George Washington to be today. But in some ways, George Washington is the ultimate comeback story. It was not by any means a foregone conclusion that he would become the stalwart leader that we know of from the history books. Talk about George Washington's early years and take us through his trajectory.
He's born to a successful family, and he's in comfortable circumstances, but his father dies when he's 11, and all of the good assets go to his two older half-brothers. His mother is left as a single mother of five children without enough resources, basically. So his teenage years are somewhat scrambling, and he can't go to school the way his elder brothers did. He goes to work at age 16 as a surveyor, and he makes his own way. Now, he has advantages that not everybody does, but that's an important part of the story, because he always has that, I think, sense of, I had to earn my way here. It wasn't handed to me. He has a couple of wonderful experiences as a 21-year-old guy who is sent on missions to the frontier to deal with French soldiers there. He's really a diplomatic emissary, and he's quite heroic in getting through terrible winter cold, rather like what Texas has been through, frankly. Hmm. And he really distinguishes himself. And I think, you know, he's a young man, and it goes to his head a bit. He is ultimately placed in charge of the Virginia Regiment on the frontier during the French and Indian War. And it is a sobering experience. For 3 or 4 years, he knows nothing but defeat, some of which are his fault, some of which are not. And his soldiers desert at a high rate. They get sick and die. They go off to fight Indians, and they can't ever even find them in the woods. And when they find them, they're getting ambushed. So it all goes badly. And ultimately, he ends up trying to leap the chain of command. He annoys all his superior officers. He infuriates the governor who had been sponsoring him, the royal governor of Virginia. And he finally leaves the service at the end of 1758, and he's pretty much fouled the nest. I mean, he's not going to have a military career, because all the people who are in the position to help him really don't like him and don't trust him. And I think he knows this is a bad start, and he decides to reinvent himself. And it is a comeback story. He does it in a very self-conscious, careful way. He wants to amass assets, so he marries a rich woman. It's always been a good strategy. He lucks into ownership of Mount Vernon, older brother and the brother's widow and his daughter all die, and so he gets it, and he decides to make his fortune there, and he decides to make a political career. It's a big change from the military career he had been aiming at, but he really applies himself to it. And this is a stage, it's about 16 years of his life that people tend to skip over, but he really went to school in the colonial legislature, the House of Burgesses, and in local government institutions.
I want to go back to the insecurities that you alluded to earlier, David. You write that Washington had a meager education, a temper that terrified those who saw him lose it, a cockiness that could make him reckless, and a deep financial insecurity that could lead him close to greed. Yet in history, we know Washington for his wisdom, his prudence, his restraint. How did he conquer those deficits? What's at the root of this reinvention, I guess? Those are, seems to be pretty formidable deficits. And yet, again, he seems to overcome them with relative ease.
I'm not sure he ever got over the financial insecurity.
Fair enough.
That really haunted him his whole life. I think it was, and he was very candid about this in letters, that he really cared about his reputation. And it's a term that we can sort of let sort of flash by us, and we don't understand how important this was. And it's not, you know, that he'd be a celebrity, but it's that he'd be thought of well by his peers. And I actually think when you chisel down to what a lot of us do in the world, we do want to be thought of well by our peers. And we want to demonstrate that we have character, that we have integrity, that we are worthy of trust. And that was most important to him. And I think that was his motivation for trying to control his other, you know, less admirable qualities. And I think he dedicated a lot of his life to it, to the control.
You mentioned Washington's financial insecurities, and those who have been to Mount Vernon would be surprised to know that Washington was insecure about his finances. What's at the root of that?
I do think it's his early years. When, there's this, we just happen to know this one anecdote. He's supposed to go to some event at the Fairfaxes, and their Fairfaxes were the richest people in the area, and they owned a huge chunk of Virginia. It was the size of the state of New Hampshire. And he desperately wanted to impress the Fairfaxes, but he didn't have enough feed for his horse, so he didn't go. That was totally unacceptable to him. And I think it seared him. It is a financial insecurity you can see in his mother. I think she was reasonably had trouble making ends meet. And he, you know, Mount Vernon was a bit of, this is a non sequitur, a bit of a Potemkin village at some level. It looked a lot more prosperous than it was. Mm. He tried to make a go of it as a tobacco planter. That didn't work because the soil wasn't good enough. He had a terrible problem with soil erosion and gullying, which is what they used to call it. And he never got as far ahead of the game as he wanted to. And then he went off for 8 years to run the army or lead the army. So things went back into the ditch. Back at Mount Vernon, it was not run well. And, you know, he never felt that he was on top of it. And then he went off to be president. Had he only run Mount Vernon, he probably could have handled his financial insecurities. But he had all this public service, and so he didn't.
So the marriage to Martha Washington was to some degree calculated. Is it a financial arrangement? Is it a love story? What's at the root of that marriage, David?
It's hard to be definitive because they burned each other's letters, and that was customary at the time. And you can understand why they would. George Washington was not going to marry a woman who didn't have money. He needed that for his plan for life, for his ambition. So he was going to marry a woman with money. Every indication we have is that they were a very congenial couple, and that it was a love match. But it's hard to look inside somebody else's marriage, and certainly from 270 years later. There is no evidence that either of them was straying. There is no evidence of great contention between them. And there are people who, you know, tell little anecdotes that sound like they rather doted on each other. They were a funny looking couple. He was 6'2" and she was under 5 feet. He was slender and athletic, and she was sort of round and soft. One of my favorite factoids is he was a great dancer and loved to dance. and a woman who investigated his dancing practices at different balls could find no evidence that he had ever danced with Martha. You know, I wondered if, you know, she like didn't like to dance or just felt if, you know, they made an odd looking couple or what the story was. But it's a peculiar fact.
So just as George Washington became a great military leader, he also became a great political leader, which you're referencing. But the two disciplines are very different. What makes Washington such a great political leader? You highlighted one thing, which he knows where the power is. He's able to identify that. But what else makes him a great political leader?
Well, I might even quarrel a little. I was talking to somebody recently who was from a military background, and he said that nobody plays politics like military officers in the officer corps. So I think they learned some skills.
Fair enough.
But he, you know, he was able to, and I am harping back, but he was able to create this atmosphere of trust that if you give him power, he will exercise it in a careful way. When he became commander in chief at Continental Congress, and this is a group of people who had no idea how to run a country and suddenly had to, was very clear that he worked for them and that they, you know, he had to be sure that he didn't rush off and become Julius Caesar. And he was always at great pains to make it clear to them that that's exactly right. And whatever they told him to do, whether he thought it was smart or not, he would do. I mean, he might push back and say, gee, that's not a good idea. But if they told him to do it, that's what he would do. And he understood that the sovereign was the legislature. It was not the army. And, all you know, it accreted over the years, this sort of self-denying, this careful conduct to create a sense among most Americans that he was a fellow who would not abuse trust.
Well, you talked about his bravery, which is, and having read about Washington, it is striking how absolutely courageous he is in the line of fire, literally. But maybe offer a story, your favorite story, reflecting George Washington's courage.
Well, the moment in his military career, and I don't dwell on his time as with the Continental Army because I wanted to talk about this other idea, but I was and did include the Battle of Monmouth and Valley Forge, which leads up to the Battle of Monmouth, mostly because that was a moment that I think showed us what Washington really brought to a situation. The Battle of Monmouth was a, he had to have a victory. He had spent an entire year in 1777 losing battles. And he needed to, he'd brought the army out of Valley Forge in much better shape. And he had to win, or, you know, he was going to maybe lose the leadership position. And the battle starts out exactly how he didn't want it to. Very ineffective, sort of marching here and there, and nobody can figure out how to fight the British. And he is delegated to a general, Charles Lee, who doesn't really want to have a battle. And it's been set up miserably. And when Washington finally arrives at the battlefield, where he thought Lee was probably getting ready to set things up for a real contest, he finds everybody's retreating. And they're all running past him. It's 105 degrees. It's the hottest day New Jersey has seen in a century. And he loses it. He gets furious. And nobody can miss it. He chews Lee out for a very short time because the British are coming. They're 15 minutes behind him. And he just immediately sets up his defensive position, finds exactly the right place. He had a tendency to be too elaborate in battles, to have too complicated a battle plan. But on this moment of improvisation, he absolutely gets everything right. and lures the British to attack him on the high ground, which is the one thing they said they would never do after Bunker Hill, but they did it again. And he wins the victory. Now, some military historians will tell you that it was a draw, and I think that's not true. I think the Americans woke up the next morning and the British had left, so they said, we won. that's what everybody thought. And it was a moment of his personal leadership during the actual fighting, which probably lasted no more than an hour. He is on a horse, as always. He is the tallest man on the battlefield. He is the best target anybody has ever seen. And he doesn't bat an eyelash. Mm. It's just what he does. He's got this crazy sense that I'm going to be okay. Or if I'm not going to be okay, nobody's going to see me run. And that is an inspirational moment when you're risking your life to be with somebody who can control that fear, control the terror that you've got to feel. That's a special connection you do feel, and a bond.
One of the things I took away from this book and learned was that Washington was a far more empathetic figure than I thought he was. And we hear a lot about the importance of empathy in leadership in recent years, though it's almost a new concept. But when I thought of Washington before, I thought of this distant, remote figure. And yet, as you point out, part of his great leadership is in his empathy. Where does that empathy come from in George Washington?
You know, this is putting the guy on the couch when he's been dead for so long. But I do think it comes from his insecurities. He was aware of his flaws. He'd had to look them in the eye. And, it's wonderful to read his a couple letters in late in life. In one he sends to a friend in Virginia. He's the new president, and he says, please tell me what everybody's saying about how things are going with the new government. Particularly tell me the things we're doing wrong. Because maybe I need to change something, or maybe I just need to explain myself better. That's a very modest thing to say. He also, this is in his personal life, also late in life, he writes, he'd spent years amassing all this land on the Western frontier, 30,000, 50,000 acres, and he never made a dime out of it. And he finally admits it in his final years, and basically says, boy, that was a really bad mistake. he was a guy who could look at his mistakes and his failings and say, yeah, I messed that up.
Yes. Again, another thing I really learned from this, David, is his humility. His humility is what makes him a great leader. I've often heard from another George W. Bush, the importance of humility and leadership. And you really see it in the profile you've created of Washington in this book. Washington is often called our indispensable founding father. And I know this is a massive hypothetical, but had it fallen to anyone else to become our nation's first president, would the United States have survived?
I question it. There were a lot of forces tearing the different regions apart. They didn't have that as much in common as you might hope. In the 1780s, after the war and before the Constitution, there was open talk of having three confederacies, the New England states, the Middle states, and the Southern states. We didn't have real continental traditions. There had been the Congress, there had been the Army. There was George Washington. I mean, those were the glue. And the Army was gone in the 1780s. So I think he was a terribly important figure, and I don't think there was anybody else on the horizon who obviously was going to fill that role. Now, could someone have grown into it? I don't know, maybe. It's hard to see John Adams there. Jefferson was in France. I mean, it's not easy to see. I think we had the extraordinary good fortune to have this decent, honorable man there to take responsibility and do his best want us to honor the ideals that we had proclaimed. I do write a little about this. I mean, a lot of revolutions turn sour. Right. They end up being really contrary. They produce a country and a government contrary to what they said they wanted. And we may not have been perfect in a bunch of ways, but we did kind of set up a government the way we said we wanted to. And I think having Washington as the leader made that possible.
So Washington becomes this unifying figure. There are very few others, if any, in our republic at that time who would have engendered that trust among our nation's citizens in order to cohere the nation, in order to keep it together. And that dovetails nicely into my last question. You recently wrote a column for History News Network, which came in the form of a memo from George Washington to Joe Biden, his 44th successor. And one of the things you have George Washington counseling Biden to do is to draw the nation together, which he did so uniquely. But playing the part of Washington, you write, factionalism and internal strife were great dangers in my time and are again. As a Virginian, I was mistrusted by the commercial and laboring people of New England. In my first journey as president, I traveled throughout the Northeast to meet the people and demonstrate my goodwill. You will be wise to tread a similar path. So to that end, what specific steps would you have Joe Biden take?
This is a moment right now where we have the state of Texas in terrible distress. And I think President Biden needs to be concerned about that and engaged in it and needs to go and listen to the people. One of the things Washington was outstanding at was listening. John Adams called it his gift of silence. And, you know, people want to be heard. And I think he needs to do that in that right now. And I think he does need to do that repeatedly. You know, Washington did take these journeys through every state at a time when travel was really miserable. To expose himself to people, to give them the feeling that he cared, to demonstrate that he cared, and also to get to know them and to know their problems and to understand them better. You know, it's wonderful to read his diary, and he rides through Connecticut and he says, the houses look very nice. I don't see a lot of poor people here. He was learning about his country, and, you know, we can all learn about our country. And I think for the leader, it's terribly important to do that. So I would encourage him not to get shut up in the White House, which is always a risk. There's so many huge problems facing him. And to get down to the retail level and talk to people and listen to people.
We talked about Washington's integrity, including being his honesty. And I just lied. I said that was my last question, but I have one more, David. And that is, where does George Washington belong in the pantheon of presidents?
He's at the top. You know, picking between Washington and Lincoln is a fool's game. you know, they're both immense figures. Lincoln faced terrible troubles and did as well as anybody could have. But Washington, I think, needs to be there. I'd put them in a dead heat.
Is there anyone else that you would put at that level, in that first pantheon, that first level in the pantheon of presidents?
You know, I obviously we have other outstanding presidents, although not as many as we might hope. You know, Franklin Roosevelt obviously dealt with two huge crises and with considerable success, obviously war, but also with the economy. So I would put him next. We have some other presidents who did well, but didn't face the same kind of challenges. You know, Teddy Roosevelt was always unhappy that he hadn't had a war.
Right.
Because he thought he would have been great as a war president, and he might have been. You know, and Woodrow Wilson's got his troubles, and, you know, Thomas Jefferson, too. So it falls off after the top two.
Well, the book is George Washington, The Political Rise of America's Founding Father, and the author is David O. Stewart. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much. I've enjoyed it.
My thanks to David O. Stewart, to our sponsors, the Moody Foundation and St. David's Healthcare, and as always, to you for joining us. If you've enjoyed this podcast, subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Mark Updegrove. See you next time.